The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 27th, 2017. It's the dog days of summer, late August. Washington is slow, and we're going to be honest, people, there are no events worth covering here. We got no panels we want to put together. We got nothing for you. It's slow times. So Susan Hennessy and I are taking your questions. You are the guests on Lawfare. We got questions by Twitter, by email, and Lawfare's associate editor, Matt Kahn, read the questions. They're on the site, on the podcast, on current events, and just on fun stuff we're thinking about. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 244, hashtag Lawfare Questions. Take it away, Matt.
So our first question is from at Eric Houtman. Do you have a different perspective on Lawfare's role in the national conversation with its new popularity?
Get us started, Susan. What are your thoughts?
Now that we're world famous. So this is something that we thought about, particularly in sort of the post-election, post-inauguration period. You know, Lawfare was clearly appealing to a much broader audience. And so the question was whether or not we should change what we covered, we should change how we covered it. And, you know, previously we'd kind of had this pretty wonky, specific, kind of nerdy conversation about the law. I think if you look at what we've done over the past, you know, 6 or 7 months, it's been a pretty nerdy, wonky conversation about the law. So I don't think that we have changed much. I don't think we should change. I think the reason why people are coming to Lawfare more and more is because they like what we're doing. I don't know, Ben, do you have a different take on it?
No, my take is similar. So first of all, the traffic has exploded. We've had something like 6 to 10 times the number of readers that we had last year, and that was our best year. And these new readers are predominantly not national security law specialists. They're general interest readers who have found Lawfare because we have technical legal abilities to analyze certain questions that they've decided are highly salient to their political lives. And the question that we struggle with, and it is a struggle, is how do you serve that new readership while keeping faith with the old readership, which is the core national security legal readership that has been with the site since the beginning. And that is not an easy question. There's a bunch of issues where you really do have an altitude question of what level are you going to treat it on? Are you going to, for example, when you have an obstruction of justice conversation, are you going to bother to define obstruction of justice in a way that a lay reader would find compelling, or are you just going to dive into the text of the various obstruction statutes? And so those are questions that are actually pretty hard. And, you know, I think we've basically made the decision that the new readership is very welcome, but our job is fundamentally to serve the technical discussion. And
So our accommodations to the altitude level of a lot of the new readers are fairly modest. That said, we have certainly, and I think we will continue to, think about, you know, what are the explainer pieces that we wouldn't have written 2 years ago that make sense for us to do this year. And we've done a lot more of that, and I think we'll continue to. So it's a balance and it's complicated.
Our second question comes from at Josh Avraham. What is the likelihood that foreign hacking is the cause of the Navy collisions we've seen? Would such a hacking be an act of war under international law?
So this is a question that sort of has been floated in a few articles following the most recent accident on the USS John McCain. You know, there's no evidence for this at all. Basically, there has been an unusually high number of accidents involving the Seventh Fleet. And so people have said maybe it's more than just a coincidence. But there's nothing beyond that to suggest that this is an issue with targeting navigational systems or sort of any other reason to believe that this is some sort of cyber attack. That said, if it was a cyber attack that caused these kinds of consequences, that may well qualify as an act of war. You'd have to sort of know the specifics. But, you know, sort of notwithstanding some dramatic headlines, this really is just unsubstantiated speculation. The Navy has released pretty detailed accounts of prior accidents that have occurred this year. They've also relieved the admiral, and so they appear to be taking this as an issue of sort of command staffing adherence to protocol and procedure. They certainly aren't reacting like a military that thinks they might have been the victim of a cyber attack with fatalities.
So a couple things. People always ask the is X an act of war question. And I think it's important to emphasize, if you're speaking legally, act of war is not a legal term of art. The relevant question for legal purposes would be whether it is a use of force. Whether it is a use of force that would justify action in response. And the answer to that question is clearly it is. Anything that constitutes an attack on a U.S. warship, much less an attack on a U.S. warship that kills people, is a use of military force. And the U.S. government, to the extent that it has addressed questions of the use of cyber weapons, which in international law have made clear that we evaluate their use in relation to the amount of damage that they cause relative to non-cyber weapons in physical space. And so if you say, again, with Susan, there's no evidence of this, but if this were an attack using a cyber weapon on a U.S. destroyer and 5 or 10 people were killed as a result of it, there's simply no question that the U.S. military would regard that as a use of force justifying retaliation.
Our next question asks from at CN2738, will the National Security Law podcast join the next Triple Entente Beer Summit?
I certainly hope so. There's a little logistical problem.
Bobby
which is,
and Steve have to come.
Yeah,
Austin.
That Bobby and Steve are in Texas, and the Triple Entente Beer Summit is the three podcasts that are A, hosted on Lawfare, and B, in Washington. But I hereby invite Bobby and Steve to the next Beer Summit, and Lawfare will certainly pay for their transportation. Of course, we're going to have to still call it the Triple Entente Beer Summit.
We could call it the Quadruple Entente Beer Summit.
Yeah, but of course, that kind of loses the point. But sure. We'll figure it out.
I hear, hear. I mean, we'll be 8 people up there, so it will be a little bit of a chaotic podcast. But
more
I'm all for it.
From at Denton ONG. What are the must-reads for the national security law field?
Wow, that's a hard question.
It's so broad, right? I mean, national security law field is like, it just encompasses a huge amount, and there's a ton of really great books in the space.
So let's interpret the question broadly to say, Susan, what are some of your desert island national security law books?
So
can I just say we're like, that's a seriously, the fact that we can say we have desert right. island national
like
security
the books law. We would take to the yeah. desert island if we still had to practice national security law. I think sort of the indispensable text is probably David Chris's National Security Investigations.
All 1,200 pages.
All 1,200 pages of it. So it's like five books. It's a little bit cheating in the desert island game. But if you're talking about sort of what is the most comprehensive account of statutory national security law, that's probably as good as it gets. And then there are lots of really interesting books that explore sort of particular facets of national security law. I don't know that I have my desert island list ready.
Well, I would say a couple. I agree. So, but David's book is primarily a book about national security. Well, the title is interesting: Investigations and Prosecutions. So, it's very focused on the surveillance law and the investigative authorities. For a book about the key two books about the presidency and national security law are both Jack Goldsmith books, The Terror Presidency and Power and Constraint. There are a number of other really important sort of primary texts that to me are foundational in this. One of them is Justice Jackson's Youngstown concurrence, which I think actually conditions a huge amount of the way we think about this field and the role of the presidency in it.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's hard to categorize sort of the foundational texts, but there's lots of really good books. So I'm trying to think of sort of what I've read in the space or actually reread in the space sort of in the past few months. I finished rereading Jeff Stone's Perilous Times, which is about free speech in wartime, which is a really great read and especially salient to the modern conversation. But there's dozens of examples like that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the just amazing read of the last few years that I, you know, picked up thinking might be interesting and was just completely blown away by was David Hoffman's book, The Billion Dollar Spy, which is, among other things, one of the very finest pieces of narrative journalism I've read on any subject, but is also a wonderful portrait of the fragility of intelligence operations that, in particularly in this age of leaks, is really worth spending some quality time with.
From at Dan Rowe Jacobson, if you were special prosecutor, who would you be most interested to interview and what questions would you ask?
Vladimir Putin, did you do it?
There you go. I got nothing to add to that. Look, I think it really depends what Mueller is most interested in right now. So if you imagine that Mueller's primary concern is collusion, then, and I suspect it's not, but if you imagine that that's the primary concern, then you're very interested in everybody who had anything to do with organizing or engaging in any meetings between representatives of the Trump campaign and people who are affiliated, associated, connected with the Russian state. If, on the other hand, you believe that the fundamental issue is going to lie in financial issues, you are going to conduct a much more traditional gather huge volumes of information, and then the people who will be pivotal to the investigation may be people we've never heard of. They're just the people who actually know the details of certain transactions and why they happened the way they did. If, on the other hand, the third hand, your primary concern is obstruction of justice, and specifically the circumstances that led to the firing of the previous FBI director, the critical thing is going to be what the state of mind of the president was, because a lot of things can be legal or illegal depending on just what you were intending to do when you did them. And so in those cases, the interviews with the people closest to the president about what he was saying at the time, what he about why he was doing what he was doing, would be the essential pieces of evidence. Now, I think that in all likelihood, there are elements of all of these investigations that are proceeding on parallel tracks to one another, and that therefore you can't say that there's any one group of people who are most important. But that's the best I can do at this stage.
Yeah, and look, if I'm Mueller, I'm not going out there and asking a bunch of questions of which I don't even have an inkling of the answer to. You know, they'll have conducted really developed investigations, reviewed documents, talked to lots of different people so that whenever they're sitting down to actually conduct an interview, they are also getting individuals to commit under penalty of perjury to very specific, knowable factual representations, right? Were you present at this day? Were you aware of X? You know, did you receive or place X phone call? And so, you know, it's not, I don't think it's probably the sort of dramatic scenes that people imagine. You know, the New York Times headline comes out and you shove it across the table at a person. It's probably very, very careful questions in order to develop facts, and also in order to develop, you know, whether or not an individual is being honest and forthright or if they're not.
From Barbara via email, can Heather Heyer's mom name Trump in a wrongful death lawsuit?
Well, she can name her, but she's not going to get very far. So the president, under a important Supreme Court case called Nixon v. Fitzgerald, is immune from civil liability for any act that he commits in office that is within the outer bounds of his official duties as president. And so to the extent that there would be, even if there were some theory in which the president had some sort of contributory liability to what happened to Heather Heyer, unless you could show that it was purely private conduct that had gotten him there and had nothing to do with his role as president, which of course is undoubtedly false, he would be categorically immune from lawsuit as a result of it. So you can name him, but he'll get dismissed from the case.
From @NEAzel, what, if any, wagers do law folk have among yourselves?
So I think this means like lawfare people.
I like the term law folk.
Law folk? I'll take that. We have one that I'm pretty confident about actually winning, which is that we have a bet about whether or not Jeff Sessions is still attorney general as of some point in September.
Yeah, I think it's September like 12th or something.
It was made at a point in which that was sort of a question, but now that has like totally gone away. And so I'm just on easy street. Jeff Sessions, just push your head down, do your job until mid-September.
And what,
don't anger the president.
What are the stakes? Well, what am I going to owe you if Sessions hangs on?
I think
on?
Quinta has documented this all, but I think it's just somebody has to say, like, admit the other person was right on rational security.
I see. That's low stakes. I'm so down with that.
I should have upped it somehow.
Paul Rosenzweig and I have a very complicated bet about the circumstances under which we do and don't think a Republican Congress would impeach the president. To be honest, I don't exactly remember the terms of that, but suffice it to say that I laid out a series of conditions that neither Paul nor I thinks will ever be met. In which I believe that if those conditions were to happen, even this Republican Congress would impeach the president. And they involved his poll numbers falling below a certain level, a certain number of new news events, and some other complicated situations. And Paul's position is that even if those conditions are met, this Congress would not impeach this president. So I think those are the only two that
actually are... This reminded me, I think I have now officially lost a wager with Paul, which is that during the San Bernardino, Apple v. FBI kerfuffle.
That was so many centuries ago.
So many centuries ago, but really was just last February. Paul wrote about whether or not he thought the FBI was going to release the vulnerability that they used in order to unlock the phone. I think we'd set a year timeline, and I think I might have lost and may owe Paul dinner, but I will go, and maybe Jason Healy as well. I'm not sure, but I need to research this and find out if I won or lost.
On the desert island, when there's dinner, Susan's cooking.
From Renato by email, does the speech and debate clause shield senators and their staff from testimony about the president's conversations with them about Russia and the Mueller investigation?
I have a really simple answer to this question. I don't know. I'm not an expert on the speech and debate clause, and I'm always surprised at how far its protections actually extend under case law, because by its terms, it's, you know, things that involve the speech and debate associated with being a member of the legislative body. But in practice, the immunities that it creates are sometimes broader than that. They think they don't, in general, reach to obstruction of justice, but I'm sure that any effort to look at a member of Congress for official conduct would at least involve arguments in that department.
From @SFLicht, what is the likely effect of elevating Cybercom and ending the dual hat on the vulnerabilities equities process?
This one's all you, Susan.
I don't think there will be much. This is the details of the VEP are still formally classified, but to the extent there's representation from either of those entities, they have independent, they would represent themselves independently just like they do in every other way. And so, you know, the vulnerabilities equities process is about deconflicting and representing, the equities of different organizations. And I don't see any reason why sort of separating the elevation or separation would have any impact on it at all.
From @StrayArk, would a government shutdown affect the Mueller probe?
So that's a really interesting question. And I think the answer is that it probably would. So, Susan, you were at NSA during a government shutdown.
Yes.
And, like, how many people didn't show up to work?
So almost nobody showed up to work for about a week. So what happened was the government shutdown went into effect. There were no provisions for sort of national security exceptions. There was some sort of designated essential personnel, and then that was that. And then the government realized that that wasn't going to work to have NSA not work for the full, I think it was like 3 weeks that the government was shut down. And so after 3 or 4 days, they had a very creative interpretation of the Pay Our Military Act, saying that because NSA technically supported military services, that somehow entitled everybody to come back to work. I don't think the FBI was recalled under that, though, or were provisions of the Department of Justice. So I think if there was a government shutdown, probably their personnel would not be allowed to work.
I think that's right. And I think and the rest of Mueller's staff are routine government Justice Department employees. And I think unless there were some very specific reason why those people were, you know, deemed essential, they would presumably not go to work either. And so I suspect that, like a lot of investigations, Mueller's would be substantially impaired for the period of any government shutdown.
From @AJTatey, is John Lithgow lined up to voice Benjamin Wittes in the Pixar movie of the Mueller investigation?
We do all of our own voice work, actually.
But good work on the part of that tweep in identifying that there is a Pixar movie being made. We can hereby confirm it.
It's true. Our sources.
And I don't know how you figured that out, but that's really impressive. Mm-hmm. And we're hats off. Mm-hmm.
From @MikeSpamNavy, can and how should the intelligence community prevent the don't use Kaspersky stance from being politicized as part of the anti-Russia hysteria?
Which anti-Russia hysteria?
Just like that there's widespread anti-Russia hysteria. And so people are saying that warnings about Kaspersky are not based on sort of evidence, but are just part of this anti-Russia thing that is going on.
Yeah. Right. So first of all, I want to challenge the premise of the question. I don't think there is an anti-Russia hysteria. I think there is a lot of reasons to be concerned about the activities of Russian intelligence. And there are, in that context, a lot of reasons to be concerned about Kaspersky products for exactly the same reason, by the way, that lots of foreign countries have, in my opinion, legitimate concerns about American hardware and software products because of the privileged posture of U.S. intelligence and U.S. law with respect to some of those products. And I think that's, you know, in an environment in which a lot of people mistrust NSA, that's going to be a problem for U.S. industry. And in an environment in which a lot of people, including me, don't trust Vladimir Putin, that is going to be and should be a problem for a company founded by somebody who did cyber work for Russian intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think sort of the government focus and the legislative focus, the congressional focus for now really is on the use of these products in government systems. And that's an appropriate response. And it doesn't matter if people think it's part of anti-Russia hysteria. There's, you know, sort of evidence available within the government that they're relying on to make that quite responsible decision. In terms of the general public, to the extent you want to use a product manufactured by a foreign national in a situation in which, you know, you don't necessarily know what their, you know, lawful relationship is in the country of origin, like proceed at your own peril. The fact that intelligence agencies are going on record to say, essentially, I wouldn't do that if I were you. It would be wise to heed those warnings. I'm not sure why you wouldn't. But I think really we should distinguish between sort of the importance of keeping government systems safe versus sort of just everybody else.
From @GeoCommonSense. Would a preemptive nuclear strike on North Korea be a violation of the War Powers Act?
Funny you should ask. Susan and I just wrote a column on our foreign policy feed about the legalities of presidential control over launch authority with respect to nuclear weapons. The short answer to this question is that if the attack were defensive and constituted a reasonable good faith preemption of an actual strike against the United States, that's within the president's lawful authority.
From @BrianTesticles.
Now, wait, we got to pause over that for a moment because
Testicles asked a question.
Because we just said the words Brian's testicles on the Lawfare podcast. And I just think that's a moment that we've got to take to appreciate. We got to take it to appreciate.
That. I'm sorry. What did Brian's testicles ask?
@BrianTesticles asks, what would be your estimate on when Mueller ends his investigation?
Well,
You know, look, there was sort of a weird story with, I think, Richard Burr predicting it would wrap up by the end of the year. Was he talking about the SSCI?
He was talking about the SSCI investigation.
Right, and then I withdraw that. Look, these things take a long time. They take longer than people might expect. You know, serious investigations can last in excess of a year. This is sprawling. It has lots of different elements. There will be parts that are concluded early. There are parts that are going to respond sort of additional inquiries and investigation. So, I would, you know, despite sort of the fervent hopes of people who are opposed to the president, I would not expect any kind of report or conclusion anytime soon.
So I agree with that. And I actually think the implicit time frame in what Susan just said is itself generous. So special counsel investigations take a very long time. And they take a very long time because no special counsel wants to wrap up an investigation. Well, first of all, because complex criminal investigations themselves take a long time. But secondly, no special counsel who's appointed to investigate a particular set of subject matter wants to close out an investigation only to find out that there's some rock he didn't turn over that underneath is a bunch of worms that he's going to be held accountable for not having thought seriously about. So if you look at investigations that are much narrower in scope on paper than this one is, how long did they take? Well, you know, the Ken Starr investigation went on for years and years and years, and kept expanding in scope. Some of the smaller special independent counsel investigations went on for just incredibly long periods of time. And this is a very complicated, very far-flung investigation, and I think you can expect it not to wrap up anytime soon. Moreover, that's before assuming nobody gets indicted, assuming you're just investigating in order to then close stuff out. Once you indict somebody, then a number of things happen. First of all, you have to have a litigation. Litigations take place on their own pace. And secondly, you can't close out the rest of the investigation because until you've resolved the litigation and found out whether that person is going to plead and cooperate or whether they're going to get acquitted or whether they're going to get convicted and, you know, take their lumps, you can't know what the body of information that you're going to have available to you is. And so the short answer to this question is longer than you think, maybe much, much, much longer than you think, and we don't know.
But thank you for the question, Brian's testicles.
From at Howard H. Dalton, where is Pence legally vulnerable in regards to Russia collusion? Could he be that out of the loop?
I mean, we don't know. There actually hasn't been any stories or indications that Pence was at all involved in any of this. You know, there's just because people are in the Trump administration or even were part of the campaign. I mean, Pence came in pretty late, you know, doesn't necessarily implicate them. And sort of the pattern with Pence thus far has been kind of that he didn't know, right? He went on television to say that Mike Flynn absolutely did not discuss sanctions with the Russians. He's made sort of a number of public comments that turned out to be untrue and then were sort of later defended by saying, well, Mike Pence didn't know they were untrue. He actually wasn't lying. He just is completely and entirely out of the loop. So whether or not that's a strategic choice on the part of the vice president or his office is just too far down the hallway. Thus far, his sort of basic position has been that he doesn't know nothing about anything.
So, and I think there's actually some reason to believe him about that. The main reason is that he was, you know, governor of Indiana, while a lot of the stuff that we think of as these untoward meetings was taking place. He wasn't actually even supportive of Trump during the primaries. And so during the period in which some of this craziness was going on, he was not only wasn't part of the campaign, he was actually, you know, supporting other candidates. And, you know, when he came on, which was late in the summer, you know, around the time of the convention, I think it's probably reasonable to expect that most of what he was doing was giving speeches in support of the candidate. So I think, you know, in the absence of any reason to believe that Pence has exposure here, I think we should assume he doesn't.
From at Doug Bug Drown, can pardons precede convictions? And if impeached, when does presidential authority end?
So pardons can precede convictions. They have preceded convictions.
They can precede indictments.
Exactly. And they have in the past as well, right? So Carter pardoned draft dodgers in advance.
En masse. And of course, Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, who had not yet been indicted.
In terms of impeachment, when does presidential authority end?
presidential authority ends at the moment that the president is no longer the president. So people use the word impeachment as a shorthand for what's actually a two-step process, which is impeachment by the House, which you can think of as like an indictment. When the House impeaches, it goes to the Senate for trial. And the Senate then votes to remove the impeached candidate, the impeached officer. When you have been removed and the next president has been sworn in, you are no longer the president and you don't have the powers to exercise the presidential powers to exercise anymore. Until that moment, the pardon power is what it is. You have the power to exercise pardons and to use it.
From @DareToThink53, and I'm going to paraphrase this one, can the president lawfully take away military status from transgender service members?
Yes, I think is the short answer, but not without facing a lot of litigation. So we've already seen, sort of following the president's initial tweet, a number of service members bringing litigation. We are certainly going to see more litigation as the White House sends an actual sort of articulated strategy for implementation to the Department of Defense. That's been reported that it's going to be occurring sometime this week. And as we know, sort of the specifics, that'll generate its own form of litigation. But, sort of as a broad... the reasons why this order can't be implemented are going to come down to very specific legal questions, as opposed to sort of broad, you just don't have the power to do that.
So I'm not sure I disagree with that, but I'm not sure I agree with it either. So first of all, there was an excellent piece on this by Michelle Paradis on Lawfare, which I urge everybody to read, which argues that trans service people who sued over this would be likely to prevail. And I think the basic answer to the question has to be that you could imagine a reasoned process that took into account all the equities that went through a lot of steps and study that courts would defer to. And you could also imagine an impulsive tweeting president who said, get those trans people out of the military, that the courts would not defer to. And so I think, how likely the president is to get away with this very much depends on how the case ends up being postured.
From @ChrisJabelBodie, who owns the transcripts from the Senate Judiciary Committee? Is it the committee, the person being questioned?
So I think the committee owns the transcripts pretty clearly, right? There'll be congressional records. Committees will often vote on whether or not to make transcripts public or not. Now, sometimes in advance of particular interviews, they make agreements with the subject of the interview about whether or not those will be kept maintained in confidence or not. But in terms of the actual ownership of the documents, I think Congress, the committee itself.
Yeah, I think that's right. The reason the question arises today is because of this interview that the Senate Judiciary Committee did with Glenn Simpson of Fusion GPS about the so-called Steele dossier the other day. There's just no question in my mind that the Judiciary Committee has the authority to release that document. I do wonder whether Rachel Maddow monumentally overstated the importance of that interview transcript. That's a separate question. If the question is, hey, can they release it? The answer is, of course they can.
This will be our last question. @SimLirpa asks, is the pardon authority of the president too broad? What are the arguments against curtailing it in terms of societal harm?
So I would say the pardon authority is not too broad. And in fact, I think in modern history, in my opinion, the problem with the pardon power is that presidents have been wusses about using it. And we have, you know, nearly 2 million people in prison in this country. Now, only a couple hundred thousand of them are in federal prison, subject to the federal pardon power. But, you know, as a general matter, presidents have been really timid about, in modern presidents have been really timid about use of the pardon power. And I think there's a lot of policy good that you can do with it across a lot, whatever your values are as president. And, you know, for a Republican president to, you know, make a practice of, say, aggressively pardoning people who are, you know, convicted of, you know, environmental crimes that a lot of conservatives don't believe in, I think would be a particularly attractive use of the pardon power, though I wouldn't happen to agree with the values involved in it. I thought Obama's use of the pardon power with respect to large numbers of nonviolent drug offenders was, you know, was very admirable and really actually made a statement about a policy change he wanted to see that he couldn't get through Congress. And so my general view of the pardon power is that it is rightly broad and is an expression of the individual personalities of the individual presidents. It's one of the only powers that functions that way. It's unchecked, and it's unchecked by design because it's an implement of mercy, and therefore a window into the mind of the president who wields it. And for that reason, by the way, I have no problem with the idea of President Trump pardoning Joe Arpaio, who I think is a thug, and. It would say a lot about Donald Trump if he decided to, you know, that sort of abuse of undocumented aliens and abuse and defiance of the courts is something that he wants to expend his political capital pardoning. I got no problem with that. I think the remedy for that is political, and I would hope that people would keep it in mind, keep talking about it, and remember it.
So I broadly agree in terms of the pardon power itself that, right, Obama is a particularly good example of someone who sort of used that power as really an expression of his conceptions of justice. He really took it very, very seriously. And, you know, that said, there are clearly, you know, sort of abusive or irresponsible uses of the power. You know, pardoning Mark Rich, Clinton pardoning his half brother, you know, the commutation of Scooter Libby's sentence, right? So there's lots of examples in which, right, clearly it was the president's buddies or donors or family members who were sort of off the hook in ways that, you know, that's not about mercy, it's about cronyism or something else. And I think Arpaio would be an irresponsible discharge of that duty. That said, I think that because I agree with you about the power and importance of sort of having that final ability to modify justice, I don't think that you can limit the negative use without also limiting the positive use. And so I don't think that we should look at these. I think the appropriate response to pardons we view as unacceptable should be political. It should be holding the president accountable for that decision. It shouldn't be attempting to modify the authority itself.
There's one caveat to this that I think is important to mention, which is that there are certain aspects of the pardon powers that are undefined. So, for example, nobody really knows if the president can pardon himself. If you are the question of whether you should modify or limit the pardon power, it strikes me as a more compelling case that you should if, in fact, you believe that it is so broad that it includes the ability to make an investigation of oneself go away. But, you know, broadly speaking, this is a power that lots of presidents have used, sometimes abusively, and the remedies for that have traditionally been political criticism and vociferous anger. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to everybody on Twitter, on email, and elsewhere who sent us questions on short notice. Susan is laughing at me.
Special thanks to Brian's testicles.
And special thanks to at Brian's testicles. You need to do your part to help promote the Lawfare podcast. Tweet about the Lawfare podcast. Share it on Facebook. Give us that 5-star review you've been meaning to do on all the podcast distribution services you use. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only, Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.